It's on. Yeah, right. Sound check. Mic check. Right. So welcome to today. My name is Eivind Johansen. I was quickly introduced last week, and I will be talking today a bit about user-centered designs, or design methodologies for making sure that we are creating solutions that are user-centered, as opposed to I'm generally starting my lectures by struggling with the lights, because lights in particularly old auditoriums like this one are not user-centered at all. The electricians have just put up the light switches here. There is no discernible connection between these switches and what connects to what, or which switches shares which lighting. So this is just you have to try and fail. This doesn't. Oh yeah, it did something. And this one makes you fall asleep. And this one is that one, right? So there we go. And here, luckily, there is only one set of switches. In some auditoriums, there are more sets of switches. And some controls a retractable screen. Right. Yes, so this is a typical example of what we refer to as bad mapping. Okay. Right. So firstly, I want to introduce some of the literature. Which are for this subject this year. So this one is on your reading list. That is Steve Krug's Don't Make Me Think, the revisited version. This one you have to read. There will be exam questions based on this one. And also, I do recommend, it's not on your reading list, but I do recommend you getting this one. This one is it's a book by... classic. It's a new version from 2013 by Donald Norman, where he talks about the design of everyday things. This book is, as I said, a design classic. Most design educations or designers today have read this book. It is recommended as a necessary literature. So this one goes into the everyday things we all work with, that being things as simple as a spoon or technological things. And it goes into trying to explain theories about how we fail to use some things. But it's really well written. It reads nearly as a, Schönlitteratur, like a good reading book. So it's a nice story as well. Right. When I'm talking about design today, I won't be talking about design as pretty things. Because there is generally a conception around that design, a well-designed thing, is something that looks nice. When I'm talking about design, I talk about something that is well thought through, that is the result of a well-considered process, that is a thorough solution, okay? So I'm not talking about what looks nice. Okay, it might look nice as well, but I'm talking about something that actually solves a problem in a good way. So we can say that good design solves both a concrete problem and maybe also abstract problems. So, just to get that out of the way. I'm not talking about nice-looking things when I'm talking about design. I'm talking about good things that actually solve problems. So, this is an example of a general board knife, table knife. It is a general tool. It makes it so that you can have some butter on it, you can spread it on a piece of bread, and it will work just fine. Whereas this is a butter knife, which is a design solution for a particular problem. So this knife in particular is designed to be very well suited to spreading butter. So you have this extra bit up here, which makes it easy to scoop up some butter, and it's got a wider blade than normal to make sure that you get the butter nice and even. Another knife is a cheese knife like this. So it's got like a bit of a fork-like bit on the edge here, which makes it so that you can pick up a bit of cheese and you can even slice it with this knife part here. And a steak knife with a serrated edge, which makes it easy to cut a bit of meat. So all these are example on, it is all of these are knives, but these three are specific knife. They are designed to solve one particular problem, whereas this one is a general one, which you can use for everything, but it's not very well suited to cut a piece of steak, and this even less so. So we have lots of specific tools. So this goes into, again, what I'm talking about when I'm talking about design. We really need to know which problem we should solve with a particular tool we're making. So that is design. So user-centered design. Okay, what is this thing about? Well, user-centered design, which I'm going into today, is a combination of various things. It is user studies. We need to know something about the people who are going to use our solution. If this is an application, if this is a game, we need to know some characteristics about who is going to be playing this game or who is going to be using this application. And we can get to know this either by interviewing people, observing them, doing some sort of user study. There is also a method called user journey mapping, which when somebody has, say, ordered a train ticket via NSB and gotten to their destination, we can ask these people afterwards to walk through their whole the whole experience with ordering this train ticket and actually getting on the train and arriving on the final destination. So we'll walk through all of the steps involved. Did they order the ticket via phone? Did they use an application on their mobile phone? Did they order it through a website? Okay, when they did that, did they encounter any obstacles? Often referred to as pain points. Because say that they try to find a destination which wasn't clearly available. Say when we are going, if we are going to take a train to Oslo Airport, would we write Gardermoen or would we write Oslo Airport? And if a user are using another word than what we thought they would be using, will that resort to problems or will they actually be able to order their ticket in an easy manner? Right, so when we know a bit about our users, we need to kind of get a grip of the important bits of this information. And one way of doing that is getting this information and creating what we refer to as personas based on this. So when we know a bit about our users, we can kind of make believe real people that are not based on one particular person, but it's like a merger of lots of people. So they become the proto persona for our solution. So we take all the things we know about the people and we kind of condense it into one or more people that we really need to serve. I'll be talking a bit more about that later today. And then we have scenarios. Because if we know what the people need to be able to do through our solution, then we can create scenarios based on that where we have our personas actually try to accomplish these tasks through earliest versions or prototypes of our solution. So of course also prototyping is a relevant method here. So we can't just code up a final solution, throw it out there, see if it sticks, because then we've spent way too much time creating a final product without knowing if it actually serves a purpose or if it's usable by our users. So we make prototypes and we also do final bit of user testing. Yes? Oh, that there is no definite answer for that. A general rule of thumb is that you should prototype. Well, when you start a project, you should really start with a what we call a low fidelity prototype. So you should start a prototype as early as possible to test out the main ideas behind the project. I will be doing a lecture later on prototyping particularly, so I won't delve into depth about that right here now. The prototype should be made all the way through the project so that you test your main ideas, if they are valid, or there is generally there are several ways of solving a particular problem, so you need to find, okay, which is the best one. And again, these are a set of ways of making or going to user-centered designs, but there are a vast number of different methods. No one can say that this is the right way to do it, but there are lots of ways of doing it, and most companies have developed based maybe on some of these solutions, but they are developing their own way of doing integrating user testing and user-centered design in their process. So another keyword that is important for us now is usability. Usability, or in Norwegian, brukskvalitet, is a, we can call it, it's not a really a metric, but it's metric-like. We cannot put a number to it, but there are some ways of defining usability. And Jacob Nielsen is a person who tried to define usability first, and he has defined five quality attributes in which we can try to measure usability. And these are, first and foremost, learnability. Learnability is about how easy it is for someone who has never used this solution before to get some work done without the first time they encounter this product. So is it easy to learn, or do you need to have some training before, or even read a manual? So the easier it is to learn, easier it is to get started, then it's it scores better on this learnability. Then we got efficiency. And this is about when a user has been using this solution for some time. Is there any way of managing shortcuts or working more efficient as you get to know the product more in depth? So this might refer to keyboard shortcuts. This might refer to ways of automating a process. If there are particularly if there are steps that are to be done again and again and again, well, there probably should be some way of automating this. Memorability is the third metric here. And, well, some solutions we might use every day. Other solutions you might use on a more periodic scale, say, once a week, once a month, once a year, even. And is it then easy to get back into how this thing worked again if you've been away for it for some time? One particularly good example of a solution that scores very well on this metric is the Norwegian Skatteetaten, the tax authorities in Norway. If you paid your taxes, you got a form telling what you've been earning and how much you should be paying for tax, and you agree, you have to do absolutely nothing. Nothing to remember, nothing to do. So that is... Well, if you can remember that you don't have to do anything, then it's okay. But it's, you don't have to go through a complex process. The fourth is errors. And we know one thing about users in general, and that is that we all, as people, make errors. Yes? No. Users use solutions, and if the solution is not user-centered, then it might seem for developers that users are idiots. Mm-hmm. But if you sold a product to someone and they can't use it, was it their fault? Not really. Thank you. So we need to know a bit about our users. We need to know about the lingo, how they talk, which particularly if we are to create a solution for people working with economics. Okay, they're probably using a totally different lingo than what we know about. So therefore, we have to make sure that we are using the same words that they would know. If we are making solutions that are suited to us and our lingo, well, they won't use it, and we'll get to pay for that because they will be calling our support phone all the time. So it's not a good way to run a company. If you want to make money, you have to make sure that the users are able to cater for themselves. Therefore, user-centered design is a good process or a good foundation for making companies that making products that are actually making money and don't cost us a lot. But again, about the error thing here, our solution we need to be aware of that people will make mistakes, so we need to foresee which stupid mistakes is it possible to do, and are those mistakes going to take the user into unrecoverable state, or can we actually cater for them so that when mistakes happens or errors happens, that they're able to get back into the workflow for some reason. So that might be making undos, so that they can actually undo what they've done. It might be by making sure that they might have some help messages that, hey, the data you have input doesn't really seem to make any sense to the system. And it might actually try to limit the possible way of inputting data into a field so that it's only possible to input valid data. So this is like a system challenge for you guys. You have to make sure that it's not possible to make mistakes, or at least it should be hard. And least, but not most, satisfaction. I read a quote once that making a usable product is like making edible food. Is that always striving for? Or should we actually make a product enjoyable to use? I think this might go for application, but at least for games. If it's not enjoyable, if the user don't get any satisfaction after playing a game or using the application, they most certainly will not recommend it to anyone. They maybe won't use it again. They won't buy the upgrade. So again, this is about making sure that we actually have something to buy cheese with. But none of these attributes mentions the user. I've been talking a bit about the user. The user is no idiot. I will make sure of that. So we have another way of defining usability as well. And this is actually a part of an ISO standard. And this ISO standard is ISO 9241, part 11. You can look it up. It's guidance on usability. And this ISO standard says the following. So, usability is defined as to the extent to which a product can be used by specified users to achieve specific goals with effectiveness, efficiency, and satisfaction in a specified context of use. And I've highlighted some bits of this. So we can recognize efficiency and satisfaction particularly here from the other definition. But this one also defines, it makes sure that we need to know who our users are. So we need to design for specified users. We need to make sure that we know the specific goals these users are going to use the solution to solve, and which specified context of use this solution is being used in. So goals, we need to know the target, what is the end solution or the end state. We need to know who is going to use our solution and in which context. When we're talking about context, there are quite a few different factors that is relevant. So if we are talking about creating something for a mobile device, then, well, we cannot certainly know which lighting situation it is in. Most phones today have got bright screens, but we didn't go many years back until we had a phone screen that weren't legible in regular daylight outside nearly. So we need other contextual factors might be availability of data transfer. So again, a mobile device. Have any of you tried to use network on Gjøvikbanen, the train to Oslo? Can we depend on having a data connection all the time if we are working with a mobile device? Maybe not. Even though, well, you didn't go any more than the atrium in the A building, and we're in a not such a sweet spot. And then Steve Krug has also a more simplified definition here. A person of average or even below average. Don't use the idiot word. Ability and experience can figure out how to use the thing to accomplish something without it being more trouble than it's worth. If we are struggling to use a solution so much that we really can't, well, it's easier to make a spreadsheet that solves the same problem ourselves, well, then we are not, again, in a good position. People won't be paying us to use the solution, and then we have to find something else to do. So, we have different solutions, we have different users, we have target audiences, and all this together ties together to make sure that we know a bit about the users, we know a bit about the context, we need to know which problems we're trying to solve. So, I would like you guys now to think a bit about some experiences you've been using the last week, say. And I want you to talk now amongst yourselves, maybe two or three together. Talk about some good user experiences you had the last week. Okay, this might be a mobile app, it might be a website, it might be something else. So just try to talk a bit about it and see if you can recognize any. For 1.5 minutes. Okay. Did anyone have an example that they'd like to share? Yes, first you and then you. Yeah?
try to raise your voice so they hear in back. Weapons. Okay. Yeah. Okay. They might be they're easy to use and they're simple. All right, yeah. Okay, good. Try to raise the voice a bit. Did I see a hand up there as well? No? No. Yeah, so it's got an extensive set of search tools. Yes. But is it just like one search bar, or is it lots of... Yes. Yeah. But then again, so here the system is not doing a lot to help you find it, or it might be well labeled, so it's easy to see what you are searching in. Because these are search fields that are, or these search kind of search terms are generally advanced search, right? So you have to know about the or and things you have to use. So, for a target group, this might be a good solution. For others, it might not work as well because it gets too much. They just want to type in their the main character maybe and find the solution. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So you have a general search field as well. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, guys. We have some ways we can try to recognize. What we might refer to as good user experiences. And first and foremost, it's solutions that are comprehended by its users. So for some users, the example with the search field here now, it might be comprehended by quite a few of the main users, but some might not be able to comprehend what to do because they got lots and lots of different search boxes, and it might not be really easy to distinguish what goes where. But you might be able to get a really narrow search. So it's a tool that is tailored particularly for people that are interested in making narrow searches. A good user experience might be perceived as effective, so that you put in quite a little bit of just a little bit of effort and get a good output of that effort. And the solution minimizes, yeah. Now, thank you. That is correct. Oh, I want this one on my screen. Thank you. There we go. Sometimes these things slip through. It's users, yes. Thank you. There we go. And a solution minimizes the chance of error, as we've already talked a bit about. So if it's easy to make mistakes, and the mistakes makes the user go into an unrecoverable state, we may have to log on again, for example, or start again, well, it's not perceived as a good user experience. Yeah, thank you. Men Nettbuss, Oppland trafikk, ja? Mm. No, this is the mobile application, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. Okay. So that example there. You refer to yourself as messy, but I would say that was a prime example of a glitch. Glitches happen. We do these kind of some refer to them as brain farts. it's really easy to do. And so in your case, well, if you were going from somewhere to somewhere, the app might actually have suggested when you are putting to and from, it might suggest, hey, you are nearer because you have a GPS in the phone. It might have suggested, hey, are you sure you mean this and not the other way around? Particularly if there is from the time you bought a ticket and to the time you should be using the ticket, there might have been a bit of error encountering in the application, which wasn't there. So was it your fault or was it the application's fault? Ah, we blame the application. Okay. The application should be, or the good user experience can be used with little to no training at all. Again, if we are going to buy a ticket, we shouldn't be trained to it, to use it. Most application, or we can say the only people that might use with a little training is maybe elderly that aren't used to applications. And what they need the training for isn't necessarily to use the app, but it's to boost their confidence, because they're generally they might be a bit they don't believe they can do. Yes? Okay? No. To click that button, they were afraid of doing the wrong thing. Yeah. So that's a prime example. Thank you. Right. And the good user experience serves a clear purpose. If it's unclear what you are able to do with an application, or if the application or solution doesn't, if you didn't know what know of the proper goals or the end states of what we are or target user we're trying to do, well, it might be difficult to build an application with a clear purpose. We might create products that are multi-tools that should be able to do anything, but they're not good at doing one thing at all. So clear purpose is important. And it can be handled by intuition. And this word I want to talk a bit more about, because what is intuition really? Well, intuition is when we kind of have a hunch about what we're supposed to be doing. And we can create these experiences by making sure that we adhere to conventions. So if somebody has created, or if there is a way, a more or less standardized way of doing something, well, we probably should be doing it the same way, not necessarily trying to reinvent the wheel every time. So we might have differences in our applications that are groundbreaking or really, really particular or special. But we need to consider, has this problem been solved before in a way that the user might be used to? And particularly if we are making solutions to, say, a particular group of people, say, again, I use accountants or people working with money as example all the time. So if we know that they are used to they have their certain workflows and their certain languages and certain way of doing things. Well, they might have an intuition to do something in another way, and say then say say a programmer or somebody in another field entirely. And lastly, we shouldn't make the user feel silly or stupid, as we were already talked about. I will be uploading the these slides just after lecture. And this is a link to a talk by Kate Kiefer-Lee from Webdagen a couple of years ago. She talks about voice and tone and how to communicate well with users. I won't go further into that, but I recommend looking watching that talk. It's roughly 30 minutes, 20, 30 minutes, I think. So, why is UX, this word pops up now and then, user experience. Why is user experience important? And more we are experiencing what we might call or refer to as the self-help community, where we all expect to be able to do most of what we regularly used to go into a particular office to do, or say that we need to transfer some money from one account to another. Earlier, we just had to go into a bank, we had to pick a number, we had to wait in queue, we had to talk to somebody. They might be able to do it for us, or we might be able to refer to another person. Now we expect to be able to do this ourselves in a easy manner via a net bank, for example. And this self-help community thought makes it so that we are more efficient in our everyday do's and goings. And in this case, we need to also consider ethics. This goes into the form of universal design, but we also need to make sure of when we are, say, automating some services. Okay, I can use the banking service example again. When we're automating this, are we then catering for everyone? Or are we letting some people behind? Again, I can use the example of the elderly. Now there is a fee to actually do banking the old way, because it is more time-consuming for the bank, therefore more costly. And therefore, these guys who are not able, for some reason or another, to use the login features of the bank or transfer money or handle their own accounts, the people who cannot do this automatically, they're then getting a fee for using the bank as they always did it. And they didn't really have any reason to do it, to learn any other way before. Now they're getting taxed for being old. Is that ethical? Well, I'll not answer that question, but at least consider, if we are automating services, what about those who for some reason cannot use this? Consider that. Information security is another thing we need to consider, because if we are making services that are critical, the consequences of poor information security, that is security what's the word I'm thinking about? The services routines. So non-secure security routines might make it so that account information get out of hand, or that we lose our accounts for some reason or for some or other services. And even I'm sure you might have read about this, but the guy who was the man behind the recommendation for having complex passwords with upper and lowercase letters, numbering numbers in passwords, and special characters. He apologized because he didn't have enough data behind his advice, And the advice actually made it so that quite a few people ended up writing down their complex, difficult to remember passwords on sticky notes, and when they, by his recommendation, had to change these passwords every month or so, well, they just changed the one number. It didn't make the passwords more secure. Nowadays, advice go more on just make a sentence. And actually, the space character is also a character that can be used in passwords many places. And it's more secure than making difficult to remember passwords. And the again, point that we actually expect efficiency. We expect now to be able to make more services by ourselves or use them. So all these points makes it so that if we are able to create user-serviceable or what can say services with a high degree of good user experiences, well, people will use them more, we'll get a more efficient society, and everyone benefits really. Except for the elderly, which might have problems using this if you're not thinking about them particularly. Yes. So, we can argue that you should have a systematic way of approaching user experience. This goes through the fact that nobody really wants to make bad solutions. We all want to make good solutions, but we need to have a method or a system or a way of knowing how to measure that. Because if we cannot really say that one solution is better or more user-friendly than another one, well, how can we argue for putting in the hours to do some user research, to do user testing, to check out that everything works as we want it to? And also, if you don't have a method of a systematic approach to user experiences, how can we say that, okay, now is this solution good enough? Now we can go on. Now we can get it to market. Now we can start it being used. So, in this point, if you don't have any way of saying, okay, this is good enough, well, we can just keep on developing and developing and developing, discover new bugs, fix them, and it will just spiral out of control and we end up with a solution that has cost way too much. When we're talking about user experiences, mental models is really important. And as developers or as designers, we have a way of thinking about a solution. We have an idea about how a solution is built, how it's supposed to be used, what it does. And we have a really good, knowledge about how everything is built together. We can peer into the solution and see which box is connected to what and how things work. Well, when we are designing these applications or games, the only way we have of communicate our ideas is through what we refer to as the system image. That is the result of the development process. So this is the interface that is displayed to the user using this. So this is our only way of communicating. We have complex ideas. We can only display this as a set of buttons or sliders and interface elements. And as a result of this, the user might perceive something totally different because they don't have the insight of knowing how everything is connected. But by using this solution, by interacting with it, they might find that, I expected something when I pushed this button, but something else happened. So we get like this iterative process where the user, by using, by failing, by making something work, will actually learn a bit more about how the system actually works and maybe get a bit closer to a more or less correct mental model. Yes? 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 Yes. Yes. Oh. Photoshop. Yeah. Photoshop is a beast of its own. So it's not easy to learn. That is. Photoshop. It's a good example. Photoshop. Okay. Let's. Is there anyone here that, or most of you guys have touched on Photoshop sometime or another? Yeah. Yeah. So, when we have the interface, it's a toolbar with some set of icons that might or might not be easy to interpret what they're expected to do. So this is kind of the first thing the user might be able to try to approach. Okay, there's a paintbrush. Might be able to paint with it. They don't know what the complex things this application can do with images. But and then there are loads and loads of menu options and toolbars and panes, different application panes, and so forth. I wouldn't say it's a problem, but in the later versions, Photoshop has become more and more of this. I talked a bit about it in the morning. The Swiss knife of everything. It is trying to get its grasp on more and more things. Now you can do 3D modeling in Photoshop. You can, priorly, Photoshop was a specific tool to open an image, do some retouching, done. And now it is trying to do a bit too much, I would believe. So this is a program that has a steep learning curve. You cannot, probably not do any a lot of meaningful work in that without any training at all. So I won't say it's a bad application, but it's an application where it doesn't score very well on learnability. But you can be really efficient with it when you have proper training. So I don't think we can say it's black and white to say, okay, this one requires training, therefore it's a bad program. But it's bad in some ways, but it's good in others. So it's always a... you have to. It's scores code on some of the definitions which I walk through, and bad on others. And you have to have the whole package and consider: does this solve my problem or not? Yes. Hmm. Yeah, I'm a graphic designer, for example. Yeah? Yes. So it's not for your grandmother. It's for somebody that actually needs these complex tools. Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. So we need to know the users. We build the tools that these users need. And they might need complex solutions that not necessarily are easy to learn. But that's why we have graphic design education and so these are what we might call special tools for special uses. Yeah, right. So, and we can also connect that to a development environment. A guy sitting behind a counter on a regular shop won't be able to use that one. You need to have the interest. You need to have some knowledge to be able to use it. Good. Thank you. So mental models. We need to know a bit about the mental models so that we can actually try to make mental... We need to know what these guys know from before so that we can make a system image that makes sense. Okay? In Photoshop example, there might be some training necessary. So mental models are a connection between what we can say form and function. If something looks like something, it should probably behave like this thing it looks like. And that might be abstract connotations like a button, or specific things like a button. Something that looked like a button should behave properly like a button. If something looks like a button, you shouldn't be able to slide it. If something looked like a slider, well, just a press to switch it is probably not the right way of interfacing with it. So we know that people, target group users, know a bit about using interfaces or a bit about using tools, And we need to make sure that we use this knowledge and create interfaces that build on these concepts that we know the users know about, or even strengthen them. And these prior knowledges, or these concepts that we know the users know about, are based on their experiences, are based on what we call affordances and signifiers. Affordances, I must think, well, I'll be going through these terms. Yeah, I will be going a bit more depth on these two terms a bit in the later lecture. But affordances, more or less, are, again, about if something looks like something, it should behave more or less like this thing. So, and this is about physical properties. So, say we have a pane of glass. This pane of glass, we can use a marker and we can draw on it because it's flat and we are able to draw on it. But a pane of glass can also shatter. And one example from one of these bus shelters somewhere had these really, really thin and really nice panes of glass. But it was in environment where, well, there were some people who wanted to, best children in the world. They found it really fun to break these glasses. Because it was glass, it afforded breaking. The main idea was that it afforded sheltering from wind or from weather, but it also afforded breaking. After changing these glasses a couple of times, they ended up just putting up some wooden barriers instead. And these wooden barriers were also quite thin. They might have been as easy to break, but they didn't kind of communicate the same breakability. They didn't perceive as fun to break, so they didn't get broken. Signifiers is more about the, what can say, our defined communicated what can say, if you have a button, or if you have an arrow, say, the arrow would communicate, okay, that way. But if we put a sign by it that say, gives us some interpretation of what we can expect if we press that button. So if you have think of a road sign. If you have a road sign pointed to the left, well, we understand that there is something there. But if it says Jøvik, well, that's a signifier signifying what going left would mean. And then we have feedback. Feedback can take a number of different forms, but and it's really important because it helps us establish that something we've done is actually resulting in something. So that might be if we push a button, we get a rewarding beep, or we can see that something is happening. I will be talking a bit about more feedback later. I think we'll actually take a small break now. I'm a bit behind my schedule, but we'll take a 10-minute break now till 10 to half. Come on, see that. 20 past 2. Right. 10 minutes break. Ok, da går vi i gang igjen. Så jeg skal nå snakke om et par tilfeller der det kan argumenteres for at dårlig design har ført til, hva skal jeg si, til en viss grad katastrofale følger. Jeg kan anbefale å ta en titt på en bok på biblioteket med titel Tragic Design. Disse eksemplene ikke derifra, men den boka har lignende eksempler. Oh, I forgot to talk in English. Yeah. So, the first case I want to go into is the case of Three Mile Island, or that it's a nuclear reactor in Pennsylvania in the United States. And this TMI-2 reactor, it went into a near meltdown in 1979. And it was a small feedback error that was the core or the part of the reason behind this incident. So, in a nuclear reactor, there is quite a complex interface. You can imagine a room full of different gauges, switches, warning lights, and so forth. And the guy running this, the operator, was aware that there was a rising temperature in one of the cores. And to be able to cool down the core, the operator needed to make sure that some water cooling liquid was running through a valve, a particular valve. There was a red, or a, I'm not sure it was red, but there was a warning light, or a indicator light, showing that water was running through this particular cooling valve, and making sure that the reactor should be cooled down. Except, this indicator light did not show that water was running through the valve. It showed that electricity was being transmitted, or being switched to the opening valve. So it did not show that water was running through the valve or that the valve was open. It showed that the thing trying to pull up the valve was being electrified. In this incident, the valve was stuck and there was no particular indicator light showing that. So the operator believed that as this light was lighting up, everything was okay. The reactor was being cooled down, whereas that was not the case. And as I said, the result was a near meltdown of this core. So here, again, if we talked about mental models, here there was a disconnect between the operator's mental model about how this, what this indicator light actually communicated, and what was actually happening in the system. This is an example of this operating environment that the operator was working with. And there was another case adding to injury here, because if some error had been discovered in some of the instrumentation or in some of the panels, when this these were fixed, the operator or the technician fixing this hung up a note like this to show what had been done and that it was working now. And one of these notes actually covered up another warning light that could also have made this injury or this accident not happen. So again, Donald Norman has designed this control room as designed for error, not for omitting error. We have another ISO standard I want to go a bit into, and that is ISO 13407 for human-centered design process for interactive systems. And this is what we refer to as an iterative process, where we first, try to understand and specify the context of use. And this is about knowing the users again. So we have to interview users. We have to analyze in some way the feedback we get. And then describe what our users are going to do with this. Then we have to do what we call specify the user and organizational requirements. And then we have to define, okay, what is the product's goal? And then we need to know both the user's goals and the business goals. So if we are running a business, we, in the end case, we want to earn money, or we have a task of resolving a community problem maybe, there might be some goals there. So we have to specify both the users and the organizational requirements. And now about also who our stakeholders are, who are dependent on this. And then we can produce what we can call design solutions. And also I mentioned prototyping. This is one way of producing design solutions. So we know a bit, we interview our users, we get to know what both the users' requirements and the business goals are, and then we can produce a prototype that try to resolve all these problems in a good way. And then we evaluate, that is, we test this prototype or this solution to see if it solves the problem. Most often, first versions will not, and we then are able to find out, okay, what is the problem? So we try again to understand the what went wrong, what didn't work as expected. We do again, specify or look into the problem, produce new prototype, test, and so this turns around. So this is an ISO standard for producing human-centered or user-centered interactive systems. And this is one way of processing a system like this. But again, there are many ways of doing this. Yes? Well, generally, it might be a good idea to start to gather some knowledge. So we generally start up here by gaining what we often refer to as insight. We need to know about, okay, who are these? We need to talk to people. That is where we start. We talk to people. Because if we know who we are designing for, we can actually gather some of these, and we talk to them, we interview them. One thing we should be cautious about is not using general market research, where people have been answering general forms about how often do you use certain kind of applications a week, or what are your interests, or in general that. We need to talk to users. We need to get real. We need to talk to the people and actually get to know them a bit. Not market research. So, who is this guy we call user? Often we say things like the user needs to do this or the user needs to do that. But when I'm saying the user, is this the same person you are thinking about when I'm saying the user? We don't know. We need to agree on who we are talking about. So to put it a bit on the edge, you can say, is this an old, young, conservator, early adopter who are parenting 2.4 children? That's like a general person that conflicts on all levels. No. Is this your user? If you design a solution for these guys, is that the same solution you would design if this guy was your target audience? What is the requirements of this person, this user? Can we believe that she might be, when she are using a solution, that being an application or trying to reach a goal, might she be interrupted by something unforeseen? Do we know that she'll be interrupted? Most certainly, yes. And she might be absent-minded because there are so many things going on. So when we are designing, we need to know who we are designing for, because different people have different requirements, different needs, different contexts that we need to adhere to. And a saying is that good design is adapted to user characteristics. This solution was first tried out on Schiphol Airport a couple of years ago. And, well, I don't know how they measured this, but putting a fly in this tool for liquid, getting the liquid out of you guys. Pissoir. Is it just pissoir? I guess it is. It decreased the amount of spillage by 80%. Okay? I don't know how they measure that. Yes? Yeah? Well, then you might have a... yeah? Yeah? Yeah. Well, we have a process for that. So then you go back, you recognize that you have a new target audience, you try to find, okay, you talk with these guys, you find out, okay, how are they using it? Is it for getting a bit of exercise, or why are they using it? And then you might be able to make some adjustment to the game and make it even better for those guys. Yes? That is an interesting question. I never thought of that. You're talking to this one. Well, I don't think nostalgia has anything to do. Yeah? Yeah, but then again, this is an attribute of the user. So again, you will be able to recognize that through user interviews. So yes, that's just another driving force behind putting some money into this. Okay, but nostalgia, yeah, it is. It's a user attribute. If we talk to lots of people and find that they really miss their old games, well, market potential, Pokemon. Again, we need to design for someone, not for a... One common mistake is that by making sure that we make an application that everybody can use, well, we might not be able to make an application that is well suited to anyone. But if we specify and target towards some people that we have talked to, we know that this will solve their problems. Well, some people might be very well served, but we will probably also reach a larger target audience. And these guys will be well served, they will be talking positively about this product, and they will recommend it. If we make general applications, some people might use it, but we don't know. So a bit about gaining user insight. As I said already, we need to interview users. We need to interview people. And we can collect this as user stories. So we might get these guys to talk about similar products they have used, how they used them, what kind of goals that they were trying to solve or reach using these products. We might use the method I already went quickly through in the start of this lecture, about user journey mapping, where we get the user to talk about a particular or some particular experience they've got. Say that when you applied for a place at this university, you went through a bit of a process where you applied to someone optalk. You might or might not have had problems finding this study. For say, okay, let's do some hands up here now. Who of you guys knew of this course when you were applying from before? Okay. Who of you knew that you wanted to do something about programming or games or something and just found it? Okay. So these are two examples of different ways into this study program. You might have heard got it recommended from someone, or you might have tried to, you knew that you had this interest in one particular field, and you went searching. So based on these two different inroads, you have probably got different journey maps. We can look on. We could map up your process of applying here. You might have talked to somebody that has already gone through this course. You may have met Simon on the gathering, or in other ways have gotten to know about this course. Another way is observing users. And this is really valuable. If we have a running version of, say, an application or a bit of software, observing users using this tool to solve some predefined tasks is really, really valuable. And this is a good process as well. If we say that we end up in an argument with somebody trying to fund our application, and they have their defined, they have their own thoughts, and they are paying for this, so they want to make sure that they're getting their money's worth. And we can see that, these guys, they have their best intentions, but this thing they're trying to force upon us, or force into the solution, it might actually not be a very good idea at all. So what you might do is that you have a prototype of the application or a running version, and you have the actual users go in there, you put up a camera, you make sure that the user is aware that they are being filmed and that this is only for making the product better. We're not trying to test them, we are trying only to make the product better. And then we might have a video screen somewhere in a small meeting room maybe, where we are able to observe this user using this solution. And as I said, we have already made sure that we have some predefined goals that this user is trying to achieve. It might be that we are using Photoshop, for example, to do something with a picture. And then it might be a good experience for you guys watching this funder ripping their hairs off because, this thing he wanted really, 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 really wanted to work. Users might not be able to use it at all. So observing users is really powerful, both for you guys learning how people actually use these products, and for including stakeholders, people that are in some way or another involved in the process. You get them to actually experience how regular users are using their products. That's really powerful. I want to mention Alan Cooper. Alan Cooper has written quite a lot of books during this about user-centered designs. And one of the first books he wrote, which has been groundbreaking in design, is The Inmates Are Running the Asylum. And this is the book where he coined the process about with personas and scenarios. I really recommend reading that one. It's a good one as well. But Norman first. Read the Design for Everything thing first. But about the personas. As I say, stakeholders, people involved in the process in some way or another, that might be, as I said, the people with the money, people with leader responsibilities, it might be someone else who has some interest in this solution being developed. We all have our own expectations or our own meanings about how this experience should be designed or developed. And we might have well-meaning friends or colleagues who have this one really small feature that they really mean should be included in the solution. Oh, this would be really well.
really good if you just included this really neat bit on the side. Or we have others that have some good advice because they tried something else and it didn't work and you need to do it this way. Well, all these things together does not necessarily become the best foundation for an application. There are so many things here. We have our experiences. Our leader wants this, the project leader wants their own little thing in there. The others, these connections, have their advices, and we end up with a muddle or a huddle of the different things here. So, by using personas, they are again based on user research. We have talked about people. As I said, we merge this into this proto personas. They are kind of the placeholder of these general users. I will go through an example of a persona in a bit. But by using personas, we might avoid what we refer to as the elastic user. The elastic user is the user we refer to, which we, if we have a point we want to make put through, we make up a story there and then that makes the user want our solution exactly. So we have a solution that we want to implement, and then we make sure that, okay, now we find up this particular persona that or this use case where our solution really would be good. We shouldn't be making these stories up to build up under a point. We need to know about the user. We need to know what their goals really are. The self-referential designs are designs which are based on our personal opinions or personal goals or so forth. And again, we are most probably not the target audience of our own the applications we are developing. And edge cases are those who might be using our solution, but they are not representative for the main users. So we need some knowledge about the users. We might get demographic data about the users and market research. As I said, these bits of data are not very specific. We don't learn anything about the stories that the real users can tell us. So interviews are the method I would recommend. So know about the target group, get hold of some of these, talk to them, and get this information merge into personas. So I will try to quickly go through a process like this. So first, there might be different roles of users that are using our product. Say, let's use a learning management system like Blackboard as an example. There are different roles here. You as students are one role. You need to get your schedule maybe, you need to know a bit about the lectures, you need to have information about tasks you are going to hand in maybe, and other things. Lecturers is another role. They need to be able to put relevant information into this LMS. They need to be able to, if you are doing hand-ins, they need to be able to, in some way, get hold of that data and maybe evaluate it. And administrators who are managing all the different classes, schedules, and so forth might be a third role. So that means it's just interviewing one group of these will not make us able to solve the problems of all the different roles that are going to use this. So you need to group them into different roles. These different users in different roles have what we can say you have different behavioral variables. That is the needs, really. So students might use this solution through the semester to get everyday information, whereas lecturers might use this mostly in the start of the term or the start of the semester to input all the data about how this coming semester will look like and all the information needed. So it's about connecting, or we can say interpreting the data from the interviews, and then making sure that you know which user have which needs. Another than the significant behavior patterns, that might be I have any direct example now, but are there anything that is particular to the different groups that that we're able to pinpoint? And then user characteristics. Again, as students, you might be checking these schedules every evening to make sure that you are aware of what happens the day after. And when we are making personas, we need to make sure that we don't have many personas that are, very similar. We need to make sure that each persona is representative and not overlapping. And we also need to identify, is there any particular kind of person that is in the target group that we have missed out? And then we need to make another persona for those. And then we have different kinds of personas. Primary personas, which we really need to cater for. Secondary personas are personas that it would be nice to cover for. And anti-personas are personas that we don't really care about. Those are people that might use our solution, but that is more by accident than it might actually be more people we, for some reason, that shouldn't be using the solution, really. Yeah. Sure. I don't think I will go into this. I talked a bit about these different things as we went through. But this will be in the final slides. I'll just jump through this. This is way too much. Wait. So, example on a persona. So, personas need to be quite specific. We need to have a name that we can believe in. We need to have some details. So this is an example of a persona. Henriette Dahl, she is 29 years old. She is a full-time student and also a part-time nurse. Okay, so we can see that she's got quite a busy every day. That is something we need to consider. And then a bit of a story about her to kind of make her into a person we can relate to. So she became a mother for the first time in 2012, and is a full-time nurse student. Yeah, the child is in the kindergarten as she attends lectures as her cohabitant, as a samboer. Ulrik works full-time in Statens vegvesen. She is well-organized and likes to have control of everything, even if her days are pretty hectic. Every day need to be planned. Every day need to be planned, and such. She is dependent on available information that needs to be correct. Henriette is outgoing and happy, well cared for by most. She finds important to lead an active life and eat healthy. Henriette uses an iPhone and is also always available in social media. She has a relatively good understanding of technology, even if she now and then may share two personal posts in social media. Okay, I won't delve into that. She likes to show herself from the best side in her posts. So this is a selfie person, okay? So by having information like this, we can all, the developers, the designers, the leaders, we know that she is one of the main users. Okay,
in this kind of, she's a nurse, so we might talk now about a product for people in that kind of profession. We know a bit about her. We know that she has a hectic life. We know that her time is constrained. This might, affect how we develop a solution. And then we need to have some goals for Henriette. So, Henriette is continuously busy and is seldom nearby a computer. She instead uses her mobile phone to keep herself updated on everything happening in the LMS system. So now it's actually an LMS system we're talking about. This in turn makes it possible for her to have an effective day. In particular, she reads notes from the teachers, reads feedback on assignments, and other information regarding her studies. So this, again, is based on information we talked to a lot of different students on the nurse study, and we found that this is representative, or if representative for some of these, and therefore, this is not a picture of one of these students. This is a general picture. We just need someone to relate to. So often we use pictures that are free of copyright from various databases as examples, but we just need a face because as humans we relate to faces and real names. So we don't refer to Henriette here as the persona means that wouldn't have time to use our solution because she needs to get the child from the nursery, okay? We say that Henriette wouldn't have time for that. We always talk about this as real people. So, these personas makes it easier for us to distance ourselves from developing for ourselves. Because now we know that it's Henriette we need to develop for. And that is much easier than just talking about the user. Because you see the distance here now, the user or Henriette. Now we know who she is. We develop for Henriette and so a couple of other personas, rather than just talking for the user, and the user is idiot. Henriette might not have, deep knowledge about special software. But we can consider, okay, she was using a mobile phone. She's a general mobile phone user, active in social media. Okay, she knows about those kinds of solutions. Maybe we should try to nudge our solutions more in interface conventions that goes towards that kind of platforms. But depending on that she likes to share a lot, if the application we are trying to create has sensitive data in it, we might try to limit the possibilities of sharing sensitive data because she might do something that she's not supposed to be doing. And all stakeholders, that being the leaders, the designers, the developers, we can all agree upon who we are designing for. And we know that these personas are based on actual interviews and knowledge about particular users. We can have faith in these guys that we are actually, if we create a solution that we believe she would be able to use, well, our target users will probably be able to use these solutions. And we can also use these personas for a kind of evaluation during development. So instead of getting an actual user into the user testing all the time, we can do what we call a cognitive walkthrough with the person, with the Henriette. So we can try to put ourselves in the head of Henriette, trying to use a solution to solve a particular problem and see, okay, is this really easy for her or might she stumble on something? When we are using these kinds of processes, it's important to have a focus on what we call goals rather than tasks. And we can define that as where are we going rather than how do we get there. That is, a goal is an end state. If I want to make myself a nice cup of coffee. Okay? My end goal is to have a sip of coffee. But the tasks is maybe to boil some water, grind some coffee for this coffee. Do you use some sort of process to get the coffee through the ground coffee and then fill it into my mug, then drink it. So these are all tasks. They are kind of the cut-up process. The goal is still to have a coffee. And the easiest way to get a coffee is the one I will choose. That might be going to the cafeteria, or that might be using a good coffee solution. And as I said, these personas are used with what we call scenarios. And I want to talk a bit about those. So, a scenario can be described as a short description of a persona using a product or service to achieve a goal. And we have already defined what the goal is here now. So that's the end state. And again, these scenarios are also based on knowledge from interviewing our users. So we know which goals our users have, and we can then use these scenarios to kind of explain these processes. And I will have some examples here. And remember that these tasks, grinding coffee, boiling water, those are not the goals. The goals here are to get a cup of coffee. So as our development continues, the tasks needed might change, the goal stays the same. So when we have a goal defined, we can actually use that as a way of trying to improve our solutions and the ways. Because we might, new technologies might come, there might be hardware, or it might be software, or frameworks, or something. So that might make it easier for us to create solutions that makes it even easier, even better to reach our goals. But the goals, they stay the same. So, we need to have a couple of scenarios when we are trying to create a solution. And we should try to cover what we call typical situation, that is the what will these people most often be doing, which kind of problem will they try to resolve with our product. If there is something that is really important, that might be a critical situation or a thing that is, we can say, critical. Think of security measures, think of if something goes wrong, it goes really wrong. I remember from last week, Simon used the example of the instrument which was set to zero and then it went all the way through the patient. Probably should have tested that. Should have had a scenario covering that kind of scenario. And again, as I said earlier as well, we know that people will be making errors. Make sure to minimize the risk of those errors being critical. Or being even fatal. If there is something that is unclear, if we, even in the developer group or amongst ourselves and the leaders, don't really know how this thing, it might be making really a really groundbreaking new thing that really nobody has resolved in any good way before, well, this is something we should try to create a scenario to be able to prototype our way around. And as I said already, save the critical aspects. Okay, I see that the eyes are getting heavy, guys. We need a break. So, 10 minutes again. 10 minutes past. And when it comes to, just move on. But when it comes to user-centered design and lectures are not well suited for us as human beings. We can pay attention for roughly 20 minutes. We know that. So why we do have these 45-minute lectures, I don't know. Okay, back to it. So we started talking about scenarios, and there are actually different variations on scenarios. I just want to go through these base types. So first and foremost, it's stories. That is the actual stories of people using a the product or a similar product. So people talking about their experiences. And we use this for understanding what people do and what they want. Okay? So this is actual stories of people. So we try to make these stories a bit more abstract to get what we refer to as conceptual scenarios. And these we use for generating ideas and specifying requirements. Again, so this is, you might say that this is kind of merging into this, or not merging into, but it's relevant to this this ISO process for user-centered design. And based on that, we can specify design constraints, that is, which kind of limitation should we put on the product. That is, we cannot solve every problem. We need to know, limit in, tighten in, which problems we are trying to solve. And then we get concrete scenarios where we define these concrete goals, which we can then use our personas for trying to solve. For envisioning ideas and evaluating our prototypes. And then we have use cases, which are can be used for specification and implementation. So these are actually specifying how this solution should respond to any one interaction. So that is the result when we have actually tested concrete scenarios. So the user stories, collected the stories from target user. They are quite informal because we are talking to people and we're getting their input in their own words. Lots of details. Everything about, as we talked about Henrietta, that she had to get the children, her child from the nursery, that she has a busy day with school and everything. Lots of details. Some of these details aren't relevant at all. Try to discard those, but some of the details are really important. And when we have lots of interviews, we can try to find which points are going on in quite a few of these, and therefore are more important than other details. And these are context dependent, because in these stories, Henriette will, or this person we are interviewing will have a time and place for every action she's been doing. So we know a bit about where was this person when she was trying to achieve so-and-so goal. The conceptual scenarios are more abstract, so we can say that they're context independent because, well, we might define contexts that we know are relevant, but the scenarios themselves don't need to have that context in it. And here it is, we are able to try to ideate based on this. Think of different ways of solving the problems we are seeing. The concrete scenarios are more about trying to get some realism in it, because in this prior one, in these ones we might try to think the big thoughts where we really try to, okay, what could we possibly do here? How could we change the world? Whereas in the concrete scenarios, we need to bring it down on the ground. What is it possible for us to actually accomplish here? Then reality hits us with economic benefits or the economy needed, time constraints, everything like that. And the use cases, as I said, are more... actually describing the interfacing between the system and the persona. And here we can need to think also about which errors it's possible to do and how we can avoid this. How can we handle error situations that we might expect? And as I said, it might work as a specification for programming. So when we know how the solution should handle different specific cases, we might program for that. So then on to a scenario for Henrietta. For sure. It's a bit small, I apologize for that. So in this scenario, we try to we are getting one of Henrietta's goals, and we are trying to see how she handles this. So Henrietta gets up on Tuesday morning. It's 6:30 o'clock, and she has to get to the university. Ulrich, that was her cohabitant, got an unexpected request for working overtime, and the plan of the day needs to be reorganized according to the new situation. Henrietta has to move her tutorial to an earlier vacant spot to be able to get the child from kindergarten. She finds it easier to do this with her phone. Okay? So here we have quite a defined goal. She needs to, we get implicit from this text that she already has a tutorial this day, maybe in the end of the day. And this solution that she needs to make her able in some way to change this tutorial time to an earlier time. So this is quite a broad idea, this scenario here. So, okay, what might this, which kind of different user interactions might this entail? Okay, what if all the other spots are already taken? She might actually need to communicate with another student to arrange a move of this appointment. So that is one kind of scenario. So should this solution then make it so that she actually can see who's occupying the other spots to make her able to communicate directly, either by phone, instant messaging in some way, chat box, something? Or is it so that when she tries to move her spot to another vacant or non-vacant, let's say think that it's non-vacant, this spot, that it's already occupied. She moves, she grabs onto her tutorial, drags it up, drops it down on her phone, and then a request goes automatically, maybe, to this person who's occupying the spot, asking for a change of spots, maybe. So we can now start to think about which different ways is it possible for Henrietta now to solve these tasks. And then we can test it on the various users to see how these what these users find the best and the easiest ways to do this. So these scenarios, they kind of get us into the situation. We know a defined problem. It makes us try to think about how we can solve this. And we know who Henrietta is. We know a bit of her competencies. We know a bit about her situation, and we know that she's quite busy, so she can't spend a lot of time on email, conferring back and forth. She probably needs a kind of a quick solution here to make this work in some way. And when we have different scenarios, we might try to see the overall image and try to find, we can say, user behavior or ways of interacting with the system that we might actually use in various parts of the system to make a coherent solution. These scenarios are generally made or used to create prototypes. That is a kind of a series of sketches, maybe, or it might be early prototype code. And a prototype, we can refer to that as a it's a model of a non-existent product. That is, we make something that looks like something that doesn't exist really yet. And prototyping, even before we start writing one single line of code, can be based on just drawing something on a bit of paper, trying to envision a product that doesn't exist yet. So we can try out interaction by having making what we refer to as a paper prototype. If we know a scenario like Henrietta's, we can draw out different screens we can expect her to see along the way. And then we can give it to a fellow developer or a designer and say, okay, this persona, this scenario or this prototype is based on this scenario here. It is Henrietta who is trying to use this solution. So they get to read through and put themselves into the mind of Henrietta. And then they try out, and then they meet some stumbling block, maybe, and can start asking questions to about the solution that we are trying to create. And then, as we haven't yet written a single line of code, we only drawn the other sketches on paper, we can make changes really really fast. So we can try out different iterations, different variations, really quickly. And it doesn't cost a lot at all. It's just 5 minutes to make a change, or even less, 2 minutes. 1 minute. And it makes us able to exclude solutions that's non-optimal. So if we see that through this process that what we thought was a good idea, we test it on another person that hasn't been involved in creating this, we can find the big problems really early on. Again, before we've started finding which framework to use, or writing code, or developing data models, or anything. So, the reason we should prototype is so that we can identify and correct problems that might arise as early as possible. The earlier we find these problems, the less costly it is to fix it. We can consider that we have an innate problem, that is a problem that will become a problem, but we haven't discovered it yet because we haven't prototyped or we haven't tested. We might actually build our application on a faulty assumption and discover it when we are launching. That is not the situation we want to be in. Prototyping makes it possible for us to find the best solution a problem, or at least one of the best solutions. And we might test different variations without halting the process. You might have heard of what we refer to as A-B testing, where we can actually have running, if you have prototype code, we can try to interchange two different solutions to a problem if we have a number of users testing this. But then we need actually, so this is, A-B testing is often used for website testing particularly, where we can, and this is one of the reasons behind clickbaiting, as you I'm certain you're aware of, where you test different titles, and the one that get the most clicks are the ones we continue using, and these are generally not well considered. But and prototyping must also be used for showcasing an idea or some thoughts we have got about a potential product to stakeholders that might or investors that might want to fund our project. So, what should we be prototyping then? Most important is to test or prototype core functionality. So, the most important, the basic functionality of the application is important to test. And so early products or so-called MVPs, minimum viable products, might only consisting of core functionality. So we test this early on to make sure that we get these right. And again, if there's something that's unclear, and if the this is kind of repetition of what I said already about testing, so we create prototypes of these things to be able to test them. And we've got two different variations when it comes to prototypes. One is what we refer to as horizontal prototypes, and these are particularly well suited if we want to again showcase an idea for a potential investor. Here we can only see topmost functions of our product. It's not really possible to do a lot with this kind of product. We get like an overview. So if we're using a website as an example, we might see the front page, and we might be able maybe to click one level down into the hierarchy on some of the core some of the core parts of this site. So this is not well suited to user testing in any way. And then we got vertical prototypes. In vertical prototypes, we get a view of this app or this solution as if it is a full worthy solution. But it's only possible to do one particular thing to this. So this might be if there is a form or a say that we want to test a login process. Well, we might then make that process possible to accomplish, but nothing else is in this prototype at all. So it might go only through this only path. And it might be two ways of doing that, or it might be, but it's about, we know that this prototype is for testing this functionality and that functionality only. And again, it might be a paper-based prototype, or it might be a what we refer to as a wireframe, where we only make like the skin of the application or website, or it might be a bit more coded. So this might be the steps to resolve a particular scenario. We know who is going to use it, we know the goal, and it's possible to do to resolve this scenario in the prototype, but nothing else. One important point here is that it's important that we adapt our solution to the user. We cannot expect the users to adapt very much to our solutions. So, because again, it's so that the as human beings, we cannot. Well, we won't adapt a lot to. I can say. There are things about our humanity that we can't really change, and that is one of these is that we will always take the path of least resistance. Now, this is a picture taken of a bit of campus here, or in the other end of the campus. And there is now started building this building over here, and I think part of this part here is blocked off now. But when they laid the asphalt here, the idea was that people would use this asphalt to move around. Whereas what we can clearly see here is that people started going there instead. So in some big campus projects around the world, more in the States particularly, when they build new campuses, they put up the buildings, they don't put any roads at all there. They see where people move, and then they lay the roads there. So again, it's about adapting to do some, we observe the users, what they do, and then we adapt the solutions there in that mind. So, there are different considerations we need to make. We need to, now we are talking more about the user particularly. Physical considerations, there are perceptive attributes and cognitive attributes. Some of these slides have been translated from Norwegian, and not all of them have been translated very well. I'm sorry about that. So, when we're talking about physical considerations, we need to talk about disabilities, particularly. Again, as human beings, we are all different. And some people might have be left or right-handed. Some might be... colorblind, have low grade of vision, bad hearing. And might even have different physical measures, different length on the legs, arms, or even different strength or stamina. And one thing when we are considering what we refer to as universal design, or in Norwegian, universell utforming, is that we are not only making sure that people with certain disabilities are using our products, but we're actually making the products better to use for all. So, say that we consider that some people with a problem with hearing should be able to use. So we might make sure that if there is a form of feedback, it shouldn't only be, say, a signal noise. It should also be something visual, maybe. Because that would help people with a lack of hearing use the solution. But if we are in a noisy environment, it will also make it better for everyone. So for most disabilities we can consider, there is also contextual situation where the solution will be easier to use or better to use. So think of somebody that's got problem with their motoric functions. They might not be able to, an old person that's got a shaking hand. Well, if we are making an application for this guy, we might consider that the buttons may be bigger. Text might be larger, easier to read. But what if this is like a ticket service for a bus, buses that we talked a bit about earlier? What if we were in a rush, we are on our way to the bus and we need to get a ticket on our way? Well, then it will be easier for us to hit that button to read what it says. So when it comes to universal design, making sure we are adhering to standards. We have got one standard, particularly WCAG, Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, version 2.0, 2.1 is soon coming. We are making sure that applications are easier to use for all. So here's one example on a potato peeler, which is cheap and easy to manufacture, and it's really painful to use because it's got such sharp edges. A company called OXO took this and just added a mold around the grip. And now it's easier for people with arthritis, that is yicked, to a grip. And it's also much nicer for people without those kind of problems. And this mug, which regular mugs, you have to kind of bend down a bit to see where where on the level, how much water you got in it. But this one has also got a level, so you can see it from top side. It's not as precise, but it's precise enough. And it's better for all. I got this, and it's really good. Other things. So, there is a field in itself, really, called Gestalt psychology. This field was coined in the 1800s by a psychologist called Christian von Ehrenfels. And he defines Gestalt psychology as such, that perception is the human process of selecting, organizing, and interpreting visual stimuli in such a way that our experience of the world becomes acceptable and solid. So this goes about how we visually experience something and how our heads, our brains, organize this information to make sense of it all. So, if I'm showing a picture like this, it's lots of blobs. What do we see here? Yeah? Okay? Yeah. So, we can kind of get a sensation that there is a dog here. So this is some blobs of black on a white background. But we get, there is no outline of a dog, we cannot see a picture of a dog, but our senses tells us that there is a dog here. So this is based on one of the Gestalt theories. We'll get into the difference now, different laws now. So the Gestalt principles, or Gestalt laws, are as such. We've got the law of figure and ground. I'll go through them now and then we'll look into each of these. The law of similarity, the law of proximity, law of closure, law of continuation. So these are the five main ones. There are two more. I won't go into them today. So first is the figure and ground. So what do we see here then? Anyone? Hmm? A letter. What? Envelope. Oh, right. Yeah, it's an envelope. Oh, great. Yeah. Yeah, we might see an envelope here. Or we might see a blue square with a hole in it. Okay? Or is it a black square in front of a blue square? So, figure round. We might actually consider this both because it's ambiguous. When we are making interfaces, we might, if we are making games, we might play on this with ambiguity. That we can, we know that as human beings, we might interpret things different ways. So, in this case, it's ambiguous because it might be a hole because the background is black, this one is black. We might interpret that we look through it. Or it might be a black square on top of the other one. So, if we want to avoid ambiguity, we need to put in some extra measures here. We might put a white outline here and a bit of a shadow here. Now we can clearly see that this is a black square on top of the other one. Or if I now I put it, we cannot see this very nice. Let's do like this. So put a bit of a shadow here. Now we can see that it's a hole through this blue thing. And now we also inferred a bit of dimensionality on this blue square so that it's actually got a bit of depth. Figure ground is generally used in quite a few contexts. One is in interfaces generally, but also logo design is based on this. Okay? Do anyone know what I'm inferring here? Or what I'm looking for? Yeah? Yes. So FedEx logo has got an arrow here. So we can either see the arrow, or we can choose to see the E and the X. But we can't kind of, so either we focus on this arrow, which is the negative form here, or we focus on the E and the X as the form in essence. Okay, so we got a few more. Okay, this is a logo for a company that makes knives. If you, so again, it's figure ground. We can either see the knife or the, or we can interpret these shapes as the, what as the negative form of the A. Either a shovel or a dig. So, can either interpret this as number 8 or as letters. And one more. Okay. What do you guys see? Anyone? Old or young? Okay, young woman. Do anyone see an old woman here? Yeah. Okay? Is anyone not seeing a young woman? Is anyone not seeing an old woman? It's quite a few cannot see an old woman. You guys only see what you want to see. Okay? But what does I say? Okay, so this is the ear, right? We got a nose, we got a necklace. But what if I say that this is an eye? This is the mouth. This is a nose with a prick on it. I can't say prick, that is a... Sorry. Yeah, what? Better. And this is the chin, Hake. All see the old woman now? Yeah? Right. So this is a principle of figure ground. We can see both. We have got ambiguity in the interface here. And there's we can selectively see either one. We cannot see both. We cannot see both the young woman and the old woman simultaneously. We can shift quite swiftly, but we cannot see them both at the same time. Next concept, Gestalt principle is similarity. So, in this case, we see a lot of circles. Okay, we can consider that these are all similar; they are one group of circle. The similarity principle goes into now. that I've changed half of this to the color red. Now it's easier for us to consider this as a group, this as a group, these white ones are a group. So even though the distance between these are the same, we consider these as group now in rows because they are similar. This also goes for shapes. So if we change the shape of half of this, again, we can consider these. It's easier for us to consider this a group of elements rather than a line here. So now we've got a small task for you guys. I will show you a bunch of letters, and when you find the letter that is highlighted in the top row, I want you to put your hand up. Okay? So, find the letter Z now. Took some time, didn't it? Okay, it's there. So, similar shaped letters. You are looking for one, you know the shape of it, and it's similar. Let's try another one. Okay, you are still looking for the letter Z. Are you ready? Go. Okay, much quicker. So here we have round letters. We are looking for one with pointy bits. Much easier to distinguish this one. The outcome here is that if we want something to stand out, we need to make it a bit different from other shapes, for example. This is based on Gestalt psychology. This is based on the similarity rule. So if you want to highlight something, we need to make it different than the general. So this can be used, say, this is an example of Apple's website a couple of years ago. It was start of school, and they really wanted to emphasize that, hey, there is a you can get cheap computers now, or expensive computers that seem to be cheaper. If we try to make too many of these things distinguish themselves, okay, which one stands out here? None. We get a messy interface like this one. So we can consider, is this good design? Or, well, I can't refer directly to research, but interfaces like this might trigger buying some people to actually look around here and buy silly stuff, which they shouldn't have bought. Right. But nothing really stands out because too many things are trying to get attention and it just diminishes itself. So in interface design, if everything looks the same, it's harder to see what is what. If you differentiate, say put a scroll bar here and I made these corners a bit round, I changed this a bit so it doesn't look like this one. These ones look the same. They look like buttons now because I put an outline on them. These two look like buttons because I put an outline on them and such. We kind of infer more than what we had, that there is a difference. And therefore, we now perceive these as a tighter group than before. Third rule is proximity. Proximity is a stronger effect than the similarity one. That is, now that we've used some more space between these elements, we perceive these as groups. If I now again put some different shapes and colors here, even though these three are the same color, we still perceive this as a group, this is a group, and so forth. Proximity might be used for, say, have we got a list of different things? And so forth. If we use a bit of space here now, we can get these to be easier to interpret as defined groups. And again, we can use the interface example. Instead of using, here we've got all these buttons, we are using all the space we've got. But if we rather tighten them together, we make sure that we perceive these as a group, that they're connected in some way. And then we got closure. And this is the same rule you experience in the start with the dog. So here we can perceive that there is a black triangle here, but it's not. It's just Pac-Man figures and greater than, less than signs. Or is, yeah. But we can perceive that there is something missing here. It is nothing there. Our head puts the shape there because it might be there. So that might be used in logos such as it's VVF, isn't it? Yeah. Where we have got these blobs of black and we perceive it as a panda. So, question. Which letter is this? H. Okay? Yes, it might be an H, but it might also be perceived as an A, because, again, closure makes it so that we can, our brains make out the missing bits. What is this? Is I here? Yes? Yes. Okay. Or it might be a number. Again, closure. We are putting in the missing bits. We are experiencing itself. I think this is the last one I will go through now, and this is called continuation. Even though this is a still image, we get a perception of continuation. And this we might use to give the effect that we want the eye to follow a certain line. Or in games, if we want the user to find an object without really putting it out there really visible, we might give the inference, might use such a line to make them look the way we want them to look. So again, we can use it for grouping. So now we perceive these as a group and these as a group because they're kind of following the same line. Let's see here now. I need to... Yeah. I think I will actually stop there after the Gestalt theories. I know there are some... There are not a lot of slides left, but you can have a look at these. Go into cognitive attributes, a bit about concentration, memory, and so forth. But those will be in the final slides that will be uploaded. And then, Simon, you had some thing you wanted to discuss? Yes. Thank you, by the way. Yes.
And you guys can all hear me, so I'm assuming.